jump into hour number two. Michael Roll is my guest tonight, along with Gwen Byrne and Pat Jeffrey, all live from the UK, from England, where it's very early in the morning, 4 a.m. to be exact. And we are talking about things that are timeless. This is a real world we live in, but it's not the reality that we will go back to, according to all the research of Michael and Ron. Ron Pearson, of course, with us last time, and you can hear that program in the archives on January the 5th. All right, Michael, let us start with Pat. When did you, Michael, first run across Pat and meet her, and how did that come about?
Well, luckily I saw a report in the Psychic News, because I was really looking for one of these materialization mediums to come on the scene so we could repeat the experiments of Sir William Crookes and Charles Richet and all the others.
I see.
Now that we had the missing part of the universe coming through.
Yes.
And there's big headlines in the Psychic News, materializations appear at home circle. And it was written by... Not by an ordinary journalist. It was written by one of the world's foremost experts on this type of phenomena, Alan Crossley. And I knew that this man couldn't be fooled on something, so it must be genuine.
Mm-hmm.
I sent my scientific work to the medium, and she kindly invited me up to one of these demonstrations in Leicester. And that's where I met Pat and Barry Jeffrey, and took it from there. And I then wrote a scientific report of... I kept it as scientific as I could of what I witnessed.
Well, what did you tell me briefly what you saw?
Well, it was repeating the experiments of Sir William Crookes, which of course I'd read about, but this was far superior, this medium, than the one Sir William Crookes worked with, mm-hmm. because there are as many as six recently deceased people were fully materializing and walking around the room, for goodness sake.
And you saw that?
And yes, and speaking to us in exactly the same voices they had on Earth. So, and by the time I got there, they had been checked out, the people who were materializing. The journalist, Alan Cleaver, had done the excellent scientific exercise of checking out Helen Duncan, the dead physical medium. Helen Duncan fully materialized.
Were they, when we... hear the word materialize and materialization. What does it look like when they appear in the room? Do they just wink on and they're there, and then they wink off and they're gone? Or is there a fade in and fade out?
The best analogy is the beam me up, Scotty, from Star Trek.
They fade out.
They fade out and fade in. Yes. What's happening, obviously, is they're lowering their subatomic vibrations to come into our physical wavelength.
So they're vibrating at a much higher level.
That's
and
right.
Somehow they're able to lower that to
That's
come
right.
back
yeah.
down to where we are at the bottom of the pond.
That's right. And then they're as solid and as natural as we are for the short time they're on Earth. And, of course, this is how our ancestors witnessed the same thing and jumped to the wrong conclusions.
Right.
But anyway, the main thing is we've checked out these people that materialize.
Mm-hmm.
Helen Duncan... daughter was got there by Alan Cleaver, the journalist, and her daughter says, beyond any shadow of doubt, I've been talking to my mother for a whole hour. And of course she knew in 2 seconds flat if it was her mother or not who was materializing.
And then they faded away.
Yes, I think every half an hour or so, Helen Duncan's a sort of master of ceremonies, and she said, just a minute, Mike, we'll just check the medium that she's all right. And you hear her, goes across the room. She said, oh, yes, we've got a few more minutes yet before we have to break for a break. And the medium comes round. She has a cup of coffee. Then she goes back into trance again, and the people from the next world fully materialize and talk to us again.
You must have been stunned.
Well, I was terribly excited. I mean, I wasn't surprised because Alan Crossley had reported it, and exactly as he reported it,
but
happened
still,
to me.
To see it, nonetheless, it had
well,
to
I was
be...
thrilled to bits that we had another one of these mediums on the scene, because I knew then we could tell the world that we definitely survived death. And I had planned to bring in a top scientist to film all this. And then it went wrong, as you know.
All right. Yes, I do. All right. Let us talk to Pat Jeffrey now. Pat...
Yes.
Okay, you...
Still here.
Yes, I hope so. Don't fall asleep on us now.
No.
All right. Now, you lost your son.
Yes.
At a very, very early age.
Yes, he was 6 weeks off of being 17.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I try to tell people each day I'm around anyone who cares that every day is a blessing and a special, every moment is special, really, on this planet.
That's right. It is too, yes.
And it can take just a moment to go. Now, would you describe the first time you were able to see your, I hate even using the word dead, but dead in our terms, deceased,
yes.
Our whatever that means.
That's right, yes.
Your dead son. Go ahead and tell me about that, if you would.
Yes, well, can I just tell you, the very first time I saw him was not in the experimental conditions.
Uh-huh.
It was the night that he actually died.
Yes.
And I woke up, and he was standing at the side of my bed, solid. And I spoke to him, and I said to him, "What are you doing there?" And he said, "I've come home, Mum. Where else would I go?" And disappeared. And a few moments later, there was a knock at our door, which was about midnight, and it was the police to tell us that there'd been an accident. So that was the first time that I ever saw him solid, which wasn't in...
Yeah.
You know, conditions where we experiment. But anyway, on from that, of course, mm-hmm. we started to search. And we're very lucky to meet with Mrs. Gould, the medium, which was really, I think, organized by our etheric friends in some way. We had a phone call which she wasn't calling us. She was calling another phone. Some other people, and she accidentally or whatever dialed the wrong number and got us, and we started to talk about these things. She knew nothing of physical mediumship, and we became friends, and we started these experiments, and
mm-hmm.
it went on from there. In the beginning, it was just talking, and then we got what they call independent direct voice, which is the voice that doesn't actually come, as it were, out of the medium's mouth, that they build a voice box and you hear the voice in the room independently. And from there on, we started to get the materialization.
Was it your son's voice always the first time?
Yes, it was my son's voice. I mean, you just couldn't mistake it because he talks with a Leicester sort of accent, you know. And,
sure.
Even the odd swear word now and then, which I couldn't repeat. but it was definitely him and, you know, events that he could speak about that happened in his life. And when his brothers came, he talked to his brothers about things that had happened, you know.
How long did these conversations go on? Just the voice? About 20 minutes, 10 minutes? How long a period of time?
No, long, long time. As Michael has told you, we did have breaks. We would perhaps sit for three quarters of an hour to an hour.
Really?
And then the medium would be brought out of trance
mm-hmm.
and had a coffee, and then she would go back into trance, and it would all continue. And sometimes, you know, 3-4 hours we'd be there till the early hours of the morning.
Oh, extraordinary. Did your son have any problem being where he is now? Was he happy there?
He said he was happy. Yes, he has always said, you know, that he was happy because he knew we were all right. They have an advantage of us of being able to, you know that one day we will be together. They can be sure of that because they're there and we're here.
They're just waiting for you, in other words.
That's right. And, no, I've never had any doubt that he isn't happy. And now his dad has joined him, and I'm sure that he is happy too.
Well, did your husband, before he left, feel of a mind that he would be seeing your son again soon?
Yes, he spoke of him. He was very, very ill. He died of prostate cancer,
mm-hmm.
and he was very, very ill. But, yes, he did say that he'd seen Michael, that Michael was there, and also that he could see his mom and his dad, you know,
yes.
Barry's mom and dad.
Oh, how nice. Did Michael talk about time in the ether world, the real world, as it were? How is time there compared to what is here? Is there time, or is he able to choose the form of his earthly existence, as it were, and live in that form?
No, I don't think time is I mean, I don't think that it's anything like we have time. It isn't the same at all. I mean, how it works, I don't know. All I know is that when we were going to do our experiments, they like to have a time, as our time, as to what time we were going to sit. You know, if we said we were going to be there for 8 o'clock and be ready to conduct whatever, you know, the experiment, then they liked us to be there at that particular time.
So they can synchronize their watches, as it were, to our time.
I think that's something like that. Yes.
Very good. All right, we're coming up on another break here, and after the break I'm going to ask you to describe the first time you saw your son Michael materialize and what that must have been like. We'll pause, talking with Pat Jeffrey. Gwen Byrne is standing by. Michael Roll is my guest tonight. I'm Jeff Rentz. Glad you're here. We shall continue with this most intriguing program in just a couple minutes. Welcome back. I'm Jeff Rentz with Michael Roll tonight, and we're talking with Pat Jeffrey. All right, Pat, if you would, tell us the first time you got past the voice stage. And again, for those of you who were listening a few minutes ago, this voice contact didn't go on for a few minutes. Keep in mind it went on for hours with a necessary break time here and there, as it were. So tell us about the first time you got to see your son.
Well, what can I say? Absolutely overwhelming, really. The first time it was, he came over to me and took my hands and spoke to me, you know, said, "It's me, Mum, Michael." And I said, "Hello, you know, that's wonderful to see you." And obviously a little bit of a break in my voice and tears in my eyes. And he, as I say, he held my hand and said he loved me and that he was all right, he was happy. And then he went over to his dad and the same to his dad, held his hands and told him, you know, that he was okay and how he that he loved him.
How did his hands feel to you when you held his hands?
Just like our hands, a little bit, how can I say, smoother. You know, we always have a bit rough and you can feel the wrinkles and things and whatever, but very smooth.
Warm?
Warm, and, you know, and he also he asked his dad to feel his chest and feel his heartbeat, and he could actually feel his heart beating and feel a pulse.
What was he dressed like? How was he dressed? How did he look physically to you?
Well, this is a difficult part because some of it was taken in the dark. It's like developing a photograph. You can only do it in the dark, and light, daylight or electric light, you know, destroys the ectoplasm. So some of it is in the dark, but they had a torch, you know, a little hand torch that was red, covered in red. We put red material over it, so it shone red and not the bright white light. You know?
And that lit up the room. That lit up the room satisfactorily. You could see.
Oh, okay. Yes. And you could see. Yes. Well, he just looked like Michael. You know.
No question. No doubt of that. No doubt about it whatsoever.
Not in my mind. Not at all. No, and it wasn't. It wasn't just an emotional thing. You know that I imagined that it looked. There's no imagination about it. You know, he's there. And the one thing was that Michael had a peculiar. How can I say? On one of his toes, he had rather a large toe that was next to his, what we call the big toe, you know.
Yeah.
And he portrayed that, you know, showed me that, said, look at my feet, Mom, you know it's me because of my feet. because this particular toe that he had.
Was there some sense of urgency on your part that he really wanted you to recognize the fact that it was him, that he was very concerned you might not believe it?
No, I can't really say that. Yes, he wanted us to know that it was him.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there was any concern. You know, he just, you know, we accepted that it was him because not just of seeing him or but the things that he said, you know, the things that he spoke about, which were, you know, personal things and
things that only he would know.
Only he would know. That's right.
Yeah. Give me an example or two, just some of the things that that you talked about with him.
Yeah, now you put me on the spot.
It's been a long time, I understand.
That's right.
Just household things, things of life.
Sorry, he talked about his kitten. He left the day, funnily enough, the afternoon of before he died. On that afternoon,
mm-hmm.
he'd brought home a kitten. And he talked about that, you know, knew that we'd still got it. It had been in an accident, and he talked about that, how I'd looked after it and survived it with a pen filler and one thing, you know, a little dropper thing. I'd fed it with that to keep it because it was precious to us because Michael had brought it, you know. So he spoke about that. He spoke about music and to his brother. One of his brothers is sitting here now, and he spoke to him about things that they had done, you know, things that they'd done together before it happened, you know.
Yes. What did he say about life on the other side? And we'll ask you to answer that just in a couple minutes. We have to take another pause, but I'd like to hear, during all your conversations with your son, what he had to say about life over there, as we will. Michael, you're standing by. A comment?
Yes, I am indeed.
Do you have a comment?
Oh, yes, I'm absolutely intrigued listening to Pat's wonderful story. Yes, you get all these family things that happen, and that proves beyond any shadow of doubt. But don't forget, Pat was speaking to him on the direct voice for a long time before the materialization.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
They'd gone through all the family codes and
mm-hmm.
everything,
mm-hmm.
proving beyond any doubt it was Michael, you see.
Very good. All right, stand by. We'll pause for just a minute or two and come right back with more. I'm Jeff Rentz. Glad you're with us. Stay tuned. We're back talking with Michael Roll and our two special guests, Gwen Byrne and Pat Jeffrey. Gwen will be along shortly. Hang in there, Gwen. And Pat, let's get right back to you. During all your hours of conversation, just with the voice and then seeing your son in that first time and certainly subsequent materializations, you all, I'm sure, asked him what it was like where he is. Can you tell us, to the best of your recollection, what he said?
Well, first of all, he would tell us that he was met by his grandparents, or his great-grandparents, that he never, you know, met on Earth. And they were there to help him over. And then he sort of said that they have to get accustomed to where they are, their new surroundings and that, and eventually learn how, go to, I suppose, like classes. He tried to put it in terms that we would understand, to learn how to eventually to communicate, which he did. But his main job, he always told us, was to help other people, and that young people particularly, that had died tragically in the same kind of circumstances that he had. Used on bikes, motorcycle accidents, car accidents, and this was what he, you know, was his main job, to try and help them when they joined him, you know, although he didn't know them, but this is what he wanted to do, and this was his main job. But as far as sort of being there, living there, as it were, which is not quite the right word, but
so
being
I understand
there, it was just, it really, to him, because they are aware of each other, each of the spirits, I've got to say, are aware of each other, I suppose it was just like when he's here, only not physically with his parents.
They're living on, they're living in an etheric world. Does the world, as he may have described it to you, if he did describe it to you, have physicality, at least in the terms of our five senses, or is it a world of just limitless contact with so many other souls?
Yeah, thought process, I would say, more than anything. You know, because they haven't got a physical body,
right?
Like we have, they are just mind or spirit or soul, whatever it is, that survives. And so it mostly is like a thought process, I would imagine. That this is the best way he could describe it, because a lot of things they said, there was no words, as it were, for them to tell us what it was like, you know, that they could explain to us how it was. All they said was that it was, you know, wonderful, they were happy, there was no conflict between people. Like I heard Michael say to you earlier on, like attracts like, so they were, you know, you sort of gravitate, I suppose, towards the people that are of a like mind.
Pat, any discussion about coming back here again, reincarnation? Would they be returning again?
No. We asked about reincarnation, and it was one subject, and I don't know why, but it was the one subject that they wouldn't speak about.
No response whatsoever?
No, just that, you know, perhaps, oh, that may be for another time. It sort of just brushed it off, you know.
Interesting.
Yes, I had the same experience. Raymond Lodge, the son of Sir Oliver Lodge, sat next to me, and I fired in all these questions at him.
And he was deceased?
Yes, he was killed in the First World War.
Right.
6'5" of him sitting next to me on the settee. And I asked him about reincarnation, and he says, "Mike, I have no idea." He says, "Who am I to tell little Russell here that it's his time to come back to Earth?" What we're trying to get through to everybody is we survive. Let's get that through to everybody and worry about this having to come back here later on.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a red herring, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I die, I want to be teamed up with my parents again. I don't want to hear that they've been reincarnated back on Earth and I can't see them.
Shipped off again, no
that's
thanks.
That's right. So I got it straight from the horse's mouth. When you ask these people direct, they haven't got a clue about it. So we can worry about that later on, I think.
That's a good point. Pat, how many times did you get to see your son?
Oh, goodness me. Not hundreds of times.
And who were some of the other people with you who were able to visit with him and talk with him beside the immediate, anybody beside the immediate family?
Oh, goodness, yes. Strangers, friends. We had people come from, well, lots of parts of the world. We had people come from South Africa, and we had people come from Holland, and, you know, people we'd never, ever met before. People come from Belgium and Germany.
And was he amenable to appearing, as it were, in front of people at any time, any place? Was he happy to do that? Was it something
they were so happy, all of them. They were so happy to do it, yes.
I mean, your son, was he?
Yes, oh, yes, mm-hmm. yes, he was. Yes, I remember when he was, I don't know whether you want me to say this, but when he was here, he you know, on the earth plane, as they call it, he tried to play the guitar. He played the guitar a little.
Yes.
And he asked if we could get him a guitar. And so we did, a guitar. We knew someone that had got one. They bought the guitar. And he used to sit and play the guitar to us.
Wow. Better than when he was here on Earth?
Better than when he was here. Yeah, it sounded better.
How interesting. Yeah. Anything else you want to add to this, Pat? It's a very long and complex story, and you've been wonderful at bringing it to us in a very succinct way. Anything that is really of a major import beside the usual kinds of family chatter going back and forth that you want to leave us with here?
Just experiment. You know,
can I come in there?
Yes.
Go ahead, Michael.
Yes. Pat, tell them the wonderful story about how they teleported the chair from one room to another with the cat on it asleep.
Right, okay. We had a I don't know what you call a peacock chair. Do you know what a peacock chair is? It's with a very, very big oval back.
Oh, yes, okay, sure.
And it was in the kitchen,
mm-hmm.
Where, and always the cat sat on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was locked in the kitchen. Two doors, the kitchen door and the door and the room that we were in,
mm-hmm.
and the doors were locked, both of them. And we'd had the experiment had been going on, and towards the end they said that they wanted us to be very, very quiet because they were going to do a special thing. And so we were just sat there very quiet, and for a few moments it was absolutely silent. There wasn't a creak or a movement at all. And then they said, right, we're going to bring the medium out of trance now. Just be very careful. And we used to light a candle, and we lit the candle, and when the light came up, there was this big chair in the room with the cat still asleep on it. It had been brought from the kitchen, through the hallway, into the lounge, with locked doors, and the cat still sat there asleep on the chair.
Wow. Well, wonderful story. All right, stand by. We'll take a break and come right back with Pat and Gwen and Michael Roll.
You're listening to Jeff Rentz. And now, here's Jeff.
Okay, and we are back talking with Michael Roll and Pat Jeffrey. Pat, one last question for you, then we're going to let you go get your sleep, and I really thank you very much on behalf of a lot of people for sharing this. Was there ever any talk during all of your conversations about people who commit suicide here for whatever reason to get out of this veil of tears or whatever they're being bothered by? Was that ever discussed?
Yes, we did have some discussion on that, and I think it's the only way I can describe it is about how, again, they are gravitated. They're not punished. They sort of, I suppose, punish themselves. Does that make sense?
Sure. You know? No, I understand.
Yes, this is what they said. It wasn't as if they were sent to, you know, the place of brimstone and fire and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. The brimstone hotel, as it were. Yeah.
They just had to come to terms. They were shown, I suppose, or their minds would show them what it was that they had done and what they'd experienced, and they came to terms with it themselves. And I think this is what we all have to do when, you know, we pass to this other dimension, is that we have to atone for anything that perhaps we've done we're not too pleased about.
Got to get your house in order, as it were. In
that's
this,
right.
The time
well, I've asked about that, Jeff. It's very important. On one of my broadcasts, a woman phoned in and said, "Do you make it sound so nice in the next world? I'm going out to kill myself.
Yeah, no.
I can be with my boyfriend who's just been killed on his motorbike." And I think it's all a question of motive. I mean, if you commit suicide at the end of a terminal illness when you're in agony, I can't see you've got your motive right there. It's like putting a loved pet down. But this woman was going to kill herself for selfish motives. And they tell us in the next world when we ask this question that obviously she wouldn't be reunited with her boyfriend immediately because she had done wrong there. She just had to suffer the sensation of time. That you have to wait the normal sort of time. Wouldn't be in agony or in a terrible fire and brimstone or anything.
I see. She would go into a stasis or whatever until time passed.
Yes,
and her
time. Otherwise, everybody would be going out committing suicide who were having a rough time.
Yeah, well, there's enough of that going on. There's enough of that going on already, thank you.
Yes, well, so you're just going to have to suffer the sensation of time that you'd have to you have to wait your turn before you're linked up with your loved ones again.
Interesting.
Yes.
Interesting. All right, Pat, thank you very much. I'm going to let you go and get some rest, and I really appreciate you staying up so late or so early as it is and sharing. Thank you very much, Pat.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Should say good morning to Pat. And let us jump right over to Gwen Byrne now, who is, I hope, still with us there. Are you, Gwen?
Hello.
How? You sound bright as...
I'm okay. Yes, I'm fine.
Yes. Wow, very good. That was an amazing story. And if you want to go ahead and tell us once again for any of our listeners who may have come in late how you got involved with this whole thing.
Pardon?
How you came to be involved with the concept of being able to see your dead son again.
Yeah, I'll explain. I'll take over where Pat left off.
Very good. Yes, indeed.
Well, we had this phone call from Barry and Pat Jeffries with their experimental circle, and they had a little boy come with Michael, their boy. They were obviously friends, and, you know, asked could he talk to his mum and dad. So Barry and Pat and Alan Cleaver rang here. Which is quite a way away from where Barry and Pat live. And, of course, we rushed up there. And we spoke to our boy 19 years after his passing.
And how did that... When you spoke to him, how did that happen?
We went into the room and everybody sat down. It was so amazing. I mean, we were mind-blown, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean... He just came, they played music, and Pat and Barry welcomed us, and we sat down, and he came over to us, Russell, and he began to sing, because he used to sing when he was on Earth, before he passed.
And he sang, it was him, his voice?
Yes, he sang to me and Alf, his daddy, and he came as a little boy, as he was when he was on Earth,
and
9 3/4, as he said.
And he sang
Where is Love.
How in the world did you handle that emotionally?
Well, I cried, and I cried, and I cried, and I cried. And I know Alfie did too. That's his daddy. It was the most mind-blowing experience of my whole life, and I've had many, believe me. But he just simply, Mike would know this, he covered it up with a big joke and gave me a tissue. Russell did.
He did.
He's a little comic. He'd have to... You know, talk in more depth, really, about Russell, because he was the comic of the gang. He'd make everybody laugh to lighten up the atmosphere, because there would be a lot of tears otherwise. And sometimes we'd laugh so much that we couldn't cry.
My,
crazy, but, you know, the emotion is very similar.
Now, he was not quite 10.
That's right. It was just a few weeks before his 10th birthday. He was suddenly taken ill, and it was very quick, and it was gone.
My, he looked to you as clear. This wasn't a dark room where you saw a shape. You
no,
saw
no,
him.
No, he was clear. And you've got to remember, this was the early days of experimenting, was
yes,
still going on.
Yes, yes.
And the first time, when he came over and sang to me and held my hands,
mm-hmm.
and his daddy's, I'm not going to say I saw him clearly that night, because I don't think I would have been able to stand it.
I understand.
And I would have passed out.
Yeah, sure.
But to hear him singing to me, Where Is Love, you may not know the song.
No.
And it just... Well, I don't know, so I could say we were totally traumatized by it.
But what
a wonderful experience.
Yeah, wonderful trauma,
and I mean,
as it were.
I'd like to, you know, this is the reason why it happened, so that other mothers could know that their children haven't died. They can come back. And
how many times, Gwen, were you able to visit with him? Hundreds of times.
Yeah, we live quite away from Barry and Pat, and we went every weekend. My husband used to come home from work Friday night, and Saturday morning we'd be on the motorway, and we went up every weekend and had the most amazing seances. And we had, I had a pink panther given to me at Christmas, an apple. I don't know if you know what that is. If you don't, when you talk to Mike, he'll explain. I had a pink panther given to me.
Uh-huh.
And it's brought through the molecules. Mike would know more about this than I do. And he asked me to start Russell's Pink Panther Society for mothers that had lost children. Well, that's still running after all these years. And there are mothers in America that keep in touch with me, and Holland, and from all over.
Mm-hmm. Were there ever recordings made of the voice?
Yes, there were recordings, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I've got about 7 or 8 different tapes, yes.
And his voice was as animated and spoken, the same cadence, the same pitch, everything.
The same accent. It's an accent very similar to mine.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, I'm his mother.
Yes, yes.
And
yes.
But, of course, he was so extremely funny. He was funny when he was on Earth. He's even funnier now. And he was number 13, actually, of the Outer Circle. Mike has spoken of Raymond Lodge and Helen Duncan.
Mm-hmm.
Russell was the joker in the pack. That was the way it was explained to me later. Because he could just make everybody laugh.
And
I mean, that might sound crazy, because why would everybody want to laugh? But when you're in a situation like that, it would be so much easier to cry.
Yes, yes.
As a mother, especially, and a daddy.
How?
I mean, you know, it's so mind-blowing that there's nothing else to do, either laugh or cry.
I can understand what you're saying. How long ago was the last time you saw him?
Well, we were still going up to the mediums. 1989 was the last time we went.
Uh-huh.
We stayed later, in a sense, other than Barry and Pat.
Yes.
But Michael and Russell were great friends. But we could hear them laughing in the background while we were talking to other people.
How funny. What was his advice to you? What was his counsel to you about worrying and grieving over him or anything like that?
Oh, yeah, I got told off for everything.
Really?
I got told off for grieving, but not only in a nice, childish way. He just explained to me, Mum, this had to be. It had to be. And we know that now. I mean, after all these years, We can see it now, clear a picture.
He was not taken accidentally then?
No. He got cancer out of the blue. Just came home from school not well, and within a week he was gone.
But there was a design to it. There was a reason for it.
That's right, yeah. I always believed that because, you know, I wrote it. I did actually write the book that was published here.
Yeah.
And that got to America as well, and it was called Russell.
All right.
And in it, I explained that when he was born, I knew the instant he was born that I was going to lose him.
My. Stand by, will you, Gwen? Right there, we have to pause.
We'll
come right back in a few minutes with another hour with Michael Roll and Gwen Byrne.